Hi, everyone, and welcome to Embodied. I'm Anne Berube. A few years ago, I wrote a book called Be, Feel, Think, Do, a memoir about coming home to your soul. And since then, I have been increasingly curious about what life would feel and look like if I could live from a place of being and feeling, completely and fully, with radical courage. Embodied is the place where I have conversations with authors, thought leaders, artists, and creatives. We talk about what it means to show up fully for our lives, to make the courageous trek into the emotional landscape of our bodies, and to live out loud the light we were born to shine. So here we are, season one, let's dive in. So today I talk with Sage Dyer, Wayne Dyer's youngest daughter. I met Sage in Montreal back in 2015. I was producing an evening with Wayne at La Place des Arts, and Sage came along with her father because he wanted her to share her story during his talk. And that was the first time I heard her speak. And at that point, she'd had a couple opportunities to share the stage with her dad, but not that much. She was still a little nervous about presenting to a large group. Well, she did so well, and I could tell that this was her path, that she was meant to be a teacher in her own right, because she had this ease and this presence on stage, like she belonged there. So in this conversation, Sage shares the wisdom that has emerged from her father's passing, how looking back, she can see all the signs that were there telling her that his soul was preparing to cross over. And it's just so fascinating to hear that, those stories. Her path is completely opening up for her right now as a result of all the changes and the growth that has happened for her in the past few years, including having her first child. And I know you will relate to her story, so enjoy. Hi, Sage. So good to have you here today and to join me on this beautiful November day. How are you today?
I'm really good. How are you? It's so good to be here. I'm glad we're making this happen finally.
I know. It's been a long time coming. And the last time I saw you in the flesh was in May 2015. And you'd come down to Montreal to speak with your father when Paul and I were producing an event for him. Four years ago now.
4 years ago, just a few months before he passed away.
I know. So special. It is, you know, and a lot of people reach out to me and say, I can't believe I was lucky enough to be there in Montreal that day. Like, you know, some people said, oh, maybe I'll wait. I'll wait a couple years when he comes back. And the people who came are so grateful and thankful, and they really enjoyed your part that night as well. And I guess my first question to you, Sage, is, you know, looking back on that year, because I know that you're very in tune and very connected and very intuitive. Looking back on that year, what did it mean to work with him? And was there any kind of signs that his transition was coming?
So much to unpack there. First of all, I'm so grateful that I came on that trip to Montreal because I wasn't going to. And my dad invited me very last minute. He said, come, you know, I'm in New York and Montreal's a 30-minute flight. He invited me to come. And I remember we looked at the tickets and he was going to purchase my ticket because I was going to be a part of the talk. But I wanted to bring my now husband, at the time boyfriend. And the tickets were so expensive. And so Anthony was going to be buying his own ticket. And so we debated coming. And anyway, we ended up making it happen. And looking back, I haven't even thought about that till you just asked me. But I'm so glad that I came because those ended up being the last few months that he was here in the physical with us. But that year was, I was so blessed for the year of 2015 I got to spend a lot of time with my dad. The month before, in August, he passed away August 30th of 2015. from like say August 1st to the 27th, I was with him in Australia and New Zealand, traveling and speaking. And I mean, even just that trip alone, there were so many signs that he knew his time was coming. At the time, I didn't process them that way because my dad wasn't sick.
No.
He wasn't dying. He wasn't, he wasn't even slowing down. He was possibly in his prime in a lot of ways, you know, like so full of life. So
his health seemed to be at the best like that he's ever been. His diet was incredible.
Right. I mean, he had had this diagnosis of leukemia a few years before, which at first seemed devastating, but ended up being something that turned his health around and made him really look at his health. And, you know, he started on green juices and eating really mostly plant-based and doing coffee enemas and, you know, things that are
gross. He didn't hesitate to talk about that on stage at all.
He loved to talk about his coffee enemas, and he loved to, when he was doing them in the bathroom, scream, "Oh, come help me with my coffee." We'd all just have to run the other way.
I'm busy.
Right. But I could give you a few really specific examples of signs that he knew his time was coming. Mm-hmm. One of the most significant ones to me, I'll tell you two, but the first one, so I was in college and then in grad school when I had just graduated college, was starting grad school when he passed away. And, you know, I was very blessed to have a father who paid for my college tuition and for my living expenses while I was in college. So, and he did, I'm the youngest of, you know, his eight kids. He did this for all of my siblings. So I was the last one. And he had a very specific way of paying for our college expenses. He made us write up a budget. Obviously, it was different for everybody. I happened to go to grad school at NYU in New York City, which is a very expensive place to live. But it wasn't about that. He just said, write out your expenses, you know, your rent, electricity, eating, you know, food, on, and plus tuition, and send me a snapshot of it. And, you know, I'll approve it, and I'll give you one semester at a time for your yearly budget. And that's how he had done it for my 4 years in college. All my siblings, 4 years in college, you know. Wow. So when the semester was starting, say in September and in, you know, end of January, he would give us that check and we were to make it last for the entire semester. And so we had done it that way so many times. In 2015, at the beginning of the year in January, I was out in Hawaii, and he, the same way we had always done it, he gave me a check that was to last me until, you know, the end of summer when I'd be starting the next semester. And I had 3 years ahead of me in this program that I was in. So that was that. I said, thank you. And I went home. And when I got home sometime in February, just a few weeks later, I had started the semester, and he called me one day, and he was in a very like serious and sort of somber mood, and not the usual. Usually his phone calls were very funny and, you know, exciting. And this was, it had a different feel to it. And he said to me, "I just want you to know that I just mailed you a check for your remaining 5 or 6 semesters in grad school. And I want you to deposit that check and make sure that you make it last, because if anything were to happen to me, I just want to make sure that I fulfilled my promise to you and my commitment to put all of my children, and you being my last one still in school, my commitment that you get to go to school and finish and that I pay for it." And he said, my dad was very much a man of his word. So if sometimes he would agree to things when he was in a really good mood, or, you know, and he would make sure that he followed through on them, even if in the morning he regretted it. And, but so anyway, when he said that, he said, you know, deposit this check, I was like, "Dad, you're crazy. That's gotta be so much money. I mean, like I said, I went to NYU and I'm living in New York City. This isn't a little bit of money. This is a lot of money." Mm-hmm. And I was like, why are you doing that? I don't understand. Let's just keep doing it the way we've always done it. You know, send me a check at the beginning of the semester." And he just kept saying, "No, because if something happens to me, I just want to make sure there's no hesitation that you get to finish school, that there's no hiccups, there's no, you stop because you can't afford it, or you're taking out loans. I committed that you could go to the school." And when he said that, I got upset. I was like, "Why are you talking about something happening to you? This is crazy talk." You know, I was like, "When I get the check, I'll just rip it up and let's just keep doing it the way we're doing it." And he got very stern and he said, "Deposit that check, do whatever you have to do to make sure it lasts. So,
wow.
Yeah. So I got the check. I opened a separate checking account just to make sure that I didn't think I was Miss Moneybags over here and started planning trips around the world or whatever. And I remember I called my mom too. And I said, Dad's being crazy. He's sending me this check for the rest of my semesters. Like, you know, what do you think?
And what's going on?
Yeah. And she was like, I don't know, but honey, you should just do what he says. I thought she was going to take my side and say he's being dramatic or whatever, but she also said you should just do what he says. And then, you know, fast forward to just a few months later that year, 7 months later, let's say, you know, he did pass away. And
I got goosebumps everywhere, like so many times while you're talking there. Like, it's so powerful.
Yeah. And wow. Had he not given me that check, I don't know what I would have done, because I'm not the type that likes to take out debt, the student loans. And, you know, I don't know what would have happened, but all
it would have made you think about it more, and you could have changed your mind. And it was so important to him that you finished.
Exactly. And so it made me value the rest of my school that much more, that it was that important to his highest self that knew his time was coming, that this was one of the loose ends that he had to tie up before he left. So I knew that it was important for me to finish. Yeah. And I valued it even more.
Wow. So, and did you finish?
I did finish.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I graduated 2 years ago or a year ago on time, and with a master's in psychology. And what was so interesting is that's, you know, what he studied in school. And there was a lot of parallels there.
And the way he spoke about you, anyway, the way I heard him speak about you was as a healer, as a guide, as someone who sees people, who helps people, who wants to be there for others. And do you feel that he wanted you to kind of walk in his footstep, or just take off where he left off? Or
yeah, well, we had a few conversations about that, honestly, which I'm so glad that we did. Again, it's stuff that I can reflect on. But he, when I was maybe like 22 or 23, I was with him, and he had a Europe trip, speaking in different places and really holy places in Europe, Lourdes, Assisi, places like that. We went to see Magicori. Yeah. And he asked me, I had never spoken with him on stage before. It's not something I was for or against. It's just nothing I had ever thought about. My sister Serena had done it with him a few times, and she had written a book with him, but he had never asked me to come on stage with him, and I never had. But while we were in Lourdes, he, about 10 minutes before he's about to go on stage, he says, you know, let's say, Sage, I was thinking about it this morning, and I really want you to come on stage and tell your bump story. Which is the story that I shared in Montreal as well. And I can share it here after this. So I said, what do you mean? You want me to come on stage? It's in 10 minutes. You didn't even, and he's like, oh, you know the story. Just tell the story. It's no big deal. And he's brushing it off. Meanwhile, I'm having a panic attack. I've, again, never been, you know, I've given presentations in school and whatnot, but I've never been on stage in front of, you know, a large audience and told the story. But obviously I couldn't say no. So he wasn't really giving me an option. He basically said, you're going to do that, and then walked away. So I was with my sister Serena and my brother Sands, and I was like, help me. I practiced with them once. And then I went on stage and I told the story. And while I was up there, what I felt was I felt excited to be on stage telling this story. I felt like I was sort of, I don't want to call it my calling, but just like it felt exciting. It felt different than anything I had ever done before. And I had never had this feeling before of like
you belonged on the stage. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. And so afterwards, you know, I gave my little talk, I told my story, and it went really well. And, you know, and after the talk, my dad was just so proud of me and so excited. And he said, I had no idea that you were like this on stage. I had no idea you had this sort of connection to the audience and charisma. And he made me feel very good about it. And he ended up getting me a necklace, and that I almost always wear. My husband just got me this necklace, which is a J for my son Julian. So they were getting tangled, so I took it off. But it's a pendant, and from Lourdes, of Saint Bernadette, which is the patron saint of Lourdes. And he said, this necklace is to remind you of your dharma, that, you know, that you have a calling, and that, you know, this is what you should be doing. You might not realize it now. You're at the time I was 23, he said, you're only 23 years old. You know, he said, you have a lot of living left to do, but I think when you're, he actually specifically said, when you're 30 to 35, your career is going to take off.
And wow. I was like,
and I'm turning 30 in 2 weeks. So.
Oh, and your book, your new book's coming out soon, which we're going to talk about a little later, but that's very auspicious. Very. Right. That's what I remember from your presentation in Montreal as well, is your confidence and your ease on stage. Like it feels very easy. Whether or not you were nervous, you couldn't tell. You have a real comfort on stage and with the crowd, and you connect with them in the way that you tell the story. You tell it in a way that kind of awakens something in them too. Like, I think you really put yourself back into that story so that people can feel that authenticity. Yeah, so I'm excited to see what's ahead.
I do get nervous before, but I feel that it sort of gives me the energy to and the clarity to do it. Instead of being like a hindrance, it becomes almost like a boost when I'm on stage. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, energy.
Because I've heard other people say like, oh, you know, I get nervous before speaking in public. But just so everyone knows, my dad got very nervous before speaking. And I think it's very normal to get nervous. It's how you use that nervous energy. You know, can you use it to your benefit or to your benefit?
I think if you're nervous, it means you care. And it means there's an excitement there too, because you're feeling them coming. And he would pace his hotel room. He'd be walking around like just kind of pacing. And
a lot of times he would start saying, oh, I don't feel well. And it, you know, it was all in his head. And afterwards he would laugh about it. But for the hour or so before, I would just sit there and be like, maybe you're getting sick. I don't know. Like, I had to kind of go along with it. And then he would end up giving the best talk he'd ever given. Each time he outdid himself. So
yeah. Ah, so good. It is part of the process. And what a gift that he pushed through and that he allowed us to witness that. So what was your master's thesis on, or what did you focus on when you did your master's?
So I did two programs. I did a master's in psychology, which was just like a general master's. And then I did a master's in applied psychology, which was like counseling. Mm-hmm. So in the counseling, so you had a choice. You could do a thesis or you could do an internship. And I opted to do the internship and get like hands-on experience instead of like writing a book that no one's ever gonna read.
Yeah.
So I worked with high school students who it was a setting for students who had dropped out of high school. Mm-hmm. For different emotional, you know, turmoils that they were going through or reasons, you know, some of them were homeless, some of them had, you know, severe trauma, things like that. So this was a program to help them get their GED. And while they were studying for their GED program, which is in the US, it's like the high school equivalency exam. So mm-hmm. if you pass that, you get your high school diploma. They also had to be doing therapy. So mm-hmm. I was basically doing therapy with these students. And I learned so much about, first of all, how privileged I am, how privileged so many of us are, and mm-hmm. how there's so many people in this world who have roadblocks in front of them that we can't even perceive and imagine. So mm-hmm. it was definitely an eye-opening experience.
And did you enjoy working one-on-one with people like that?
I definitely did. I did. You know, working with teens is very different than working with adults because you kind of have to help them open their shell. Whereas a lot of times you get in a room with an adult and they want to talk about themselves, whereas teens don't always want to, especially with someone they don't know and someone that they don't perceive as having anything in common with them and whatever. So learning to help these kids open up to me was a gift and a big learning experience.
Wow. And do you see yourself working as a counselor going forward, as a psychologist?
Yeah, you know, that was the plan. That's why I got that degree. But then, as we were talking about before we started recording, my husband and I ended up opening a restaurant, which is a very time-consuming business. And so I ended up, I have not worked in counseling since finishing my internship, but I would definitely like to get back. And then I had a baby, so.
A little busy.
I've been busy, but I would definitely like to at some point get back into that in the next like couple years. Maybe I'm thinking when my son is in school and then I have the days off during the day.
Yeah, exactly.
This podcast is supported by real estate agent extraordinaire, Maggie McGilvery. The first moment I met her, I knew she was a powerful and impressive person. But a lot of top real estate agents fit that description. I think that's the price of admission. You want someone who makes you feel confident. So let me tell you about my second impression of Maggie McGilvery, because that's where I was really blown away. Maggie is someone with an extraordinary sensitivity to the plight of others and desire to be of service. You can see it in the way she works with her clients and the way she gives back to her community. Buying a home means something different for all of us. It's not just about acquiring an asset and a mortgage. It could be about owning your future, reinventing your life on your own terms, or creating a sense of safety and a place for your family. Maggie gets that in a big way, and she talks the talk and walks the walk. If that resonates with you and you're looking to buy or sell your home, I encourage you to check out Maggie McGilvery at soldongold.ca.
And so, can you tell us a little bit about how that transition was for you? So the day that you learned that your dad had passed away, what was that like for you? Like, you know, I can't imagine the grief as losing a father. I still have my father, so I can't imagine. But you have a very different perspective than most people on death and life after death. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was for you?
Yeah. So, you know, like I alluded to before, I had been in Australia with my father. I got back, I think, on the 27th of August or maybe the 28th. And I said goodbye to my dad in New Zealand, actually. And not even imagining for 1 minute that was the last time I was going to see him in the flesh, because he was so healthy and vibrant and whatever. But he went back to Hawaii. I went back to New York, and we spoke on the phone one more time. He called me. He actually, funny enough, called everybody that on August 30th. He passed away August 30th at night time. So he was alive that entire day, and he called all of us, all of his kids, his wife, my mother, and just because he had been, I guess, because he had been away for a while. But it's just like reflecting back, we looked in his cell phone, he called each and every one of his wow. kids and had a conversation with us the night before he passed away. And so when I received that call the next day, actually from my sister Serena, I'll spare the details of how we got there, but he basically had a heart attack in his hotel room alone. He went back to Hawaii where he lived, but his condo was under renovation. So like the whole building was shut down, not his personal condo. So he was staying in a hotel. And when I got the phone call from my sister, I was sitting in my apartment with my boyfriend. I had been gone for like a month. So we were just, you know, hanging out. I was jet lagged. And I got a call from my sister, and it was Sunday. And I thought, that's odd, because I knew my whole family was together. No one ever calls me when they're all together. Everybody else lives in Florida. And so I picked it up, because normally I wouldn't answer if, you know, I haven't seen Anthony in a long time and I've seen her a lot. So, but anyway, I picked it up because I immediately thought, like, no one ever calls me when they're having dinner. So, and I answered the phone, and I immediately could feel the heaviness of the phone call. And she said, "Are you alone?" And I said, "No, I'm with Anthony." And she said, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, What? And she said, "Dad doesn't have a pulse." And I didn't register that at first. To me, that meant they're working on it. You know, they're giving yeah. him, you know, something happened, but he's in the hospital, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, "So are they, what do they do? What do you mean?" And I started screaming. And Anthony, you know, immediately he had been watching the TV. He turned the TV off and came over, and I dropped the phone, and I was like hyperventilating. And he took the phone, and so I kind of had a moment of clarity. I thought, well, maybe he's still going to be okay if he doesn't have, maybe, you know, he's with the ambulance. So I said, is he okay? And then Anthony said, "No, your dad passed away." Oh, and God. And I was shocked. I was in total disbelief and shock, because you know, like you said, you know, you still had your father. I still perceived myself as somebody who had my father. This wasn't, he wasn't sick. He wasn't, it was so unexpected. And yeah, and it was just those initial days. All I remember was that it was just shock. And so we went to Florida. Anthony booked us tickets immediately to go in the morning. That's where all my family was. And it, you know, and it was a time of also a lot of laughter, but just sort of, there's so much happening in those first initial days. But one of the biggest things I can remember that sort of led to a turning point for me, because it was, I wasn't eating, I couldn't sleep. I was just devastated and shocked, and I wasn't at all turning to his teachings or this sort of knowing that I had about, you know, that our, I grew up with his teachings that, you know, our bodies are not who we are. We're our soul, and, you know, on and on and on, and death isn't real, and it's all an illusion. But I wasn't going to that place. I was just in the grief, and that's okay. And I have no judgment about that either. I mean, no matter how highly evolved you are, you're going to miss people when they leave.
Yeah.
And
so the physical body goes through that shock, and it's human and it's important. If you deny that, I think you create a psychosis and more problems.
Exactly. And so I was in that place, and throughout those early days, I kept having thoughts like that would run on this sort of hamster wheel of, I miss him so much. I'm devastated, you know, and just feeling so awful. And then it would lead to, how do I feel better? Just call dad. I can't call dad. You know, it was like in my life, whenever there was something really heavy or big happening to me, I called my dad or my mom, you know, and, or I reached out for them in whatever way, if we were there together, or I called them on the phone. So my mind just kept going to this place of call dad. And then I would have this realization that I couldn't do that, and I would never do that again. And then it would just be the grief again. And like I said, it was just a hamster wheel of like, my mind just playing this evil trick on me. And it's like I hadn't accepted reality yet. And after a couple weeks of this, or I don't know how long, maybe a week, 2 weeks of just staying stuck in this place, I finally said to myself, you know, dad isn't here anymore. You can't call dad. You know, this is, you have to accept this. And but you had the blessing and the privilege of growing up with him as your dad and hearing his wisdom and hearing him give advice to other people who were in the situation that I am now in for years, for my whole life. So I said to myself, okay, I can't call you dad, but what would you say to me now? You know, what have I heard you say to other people? If I could have a conversation with you, what would you say to me?
Wow.
And I remembered this story that I had heard him tell at many talks, and it was about, it was a little anecdote. I don't know that it's a true story, but it's a story to inspire someone. But so it's a story of a young man who, he was at war, and his father lived in a little village. And one day his father got a knock on his door and was told that his son had died in war. And there were many people in this village getting this same message that their child son had died in war. And that night the dad went into the town and he went to a party and he was dancing and he was celebrating. And the neighbors and the people in the town were like, what is he? I can't believe he's here dancing and celebrating. He just lost his son. And somebody went up to him and said, how could you be here dancing and being happy and celebrating when you've just learned that your son has died? And he said to the person, sooner or later, I'm going to have to move on from this, or it's going to kill me. It's going to take me down. It's going to pull the life out of me. I'm just choosing sooner. So I recalled that story and I felt like, you know what? You can choose sooner. There's no prescription for how you have to deal with grief. And that doesn't, by choosing sooner, I don't mean I never missed my dad again. I don't mean I never felt sad again. I just mean I started to see the light. I started to reflect. Instead of missing him and dwelling in that place, I started to listen to his lectures on YouTube or wherever, podcasts and recorded books and on and on and on. I realized that I had this, I was so blessed. I mean, many people lose their loved ones and have nothing but maybe some cards or photos, but I had a endless amount of recording. Yeah, a library of my dad's wisdom that I could delve into. And so I just decided to make that my mantra. You know, I choose sooner. I remember it was August 30th. So the semester was to start like September 3rd or something like that. And I immediately thought like, am I going to start school in 3 days? Or, you know, obviously I would take a couple of weeks, but then am I going to start school in 2 weeks? Like, and it was this big question like looming over me. And I felt like, how could I, you know, part of me, if I'm being honest, felt like other people will judge me if I do it, you know, even if I felt like I could, I felt like I would be judged by other people, for moving on too quickly.
Yeah.
But when I had that realization that, you know, no, there's no prescription. There's no equation. This is what works for me and I can choose sooner. And I remember I spoke to the dean of my program and he was trying to talk me out of it saying, you know, you there's stages of grief and you're in this stage. And cause this is a psychology program.
He knows.
Yeah. And he said, you're going to go through this, this, and this, and you cannot, you know, I highly recommend that you take the semester off. We'll credit you back. And on, I got a whole lecture and I said, you know what? I know what's right for me. Mm-hmm. And sitting in my apartment and doing nothing isn't going to help me. Mm-hmm. And it's not what my dad would want. And I reflected on the tuition that he had given me. And it was just like, it was, you know, it was meant to be that I pick up my life, not stop my life, you know, and use this. There's an energy in grief that is both sad, but it is compassionate. I felt like I had never been a more compassionate person than during that time. You know, it opened my eyes to, just seeing the love in my dad used to say, see the light in others and treat them as if that's all you see. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he said that or if he was quoting somebody else, but he used to say that. And I felt like I was doing that for the first time. Like I was seeing people and I was just seeing their light. I wasn't attaching judgments and tags. And so again, I just began to reflect on, that this was meant to be, that everything's on purpose and that I was meant to lose my dad at this time.
Yes.
And that meant I had the tools to move, to make this not, I don't like to say move on, but to just grow from this essentially.
Yes.
And when I decided to make that my mantra, instead of like, I'm sad, I'm stuck, I'm allotted at least 3 months of doing nothing. You know, when I decided to flip that on its head and make my mantra, like I have the tools for this. I miss my dad, but I have a knowing that he's with me. I grew up with him, telling, you know, I just have so many tools in my toolbox that I can use for this and that I can help other people. That is what changed everything for me. It was, you know, it was in that moment that it, and again, it wasn't in a moment that it changed, but it was in that moment that it started to change.
Yes.
And each day became, you know, an opportunity to grow and to find my dad in, you know, then there became so many signs. It's like, that's when I, the tuition story, that's when those things started to dawn on me, like, well, this was meant to be. And I think, and there was a part of him that knew, and that, you know, that everything is happening for a reason and on purpose and on time. And that's when those sort of thoughts started to come, is when I decided to see it as a blessing.
Yes.
And a curse.
Absolutely. And you know, grief is, they say, is the greatest teacher. And there is this ambivalence because you feel guilty because this person you love so much had given you so much. And there's this desire to keep that grief on the very human and mortal side.
Right.
You know, I remember in the first couple of hours, well, actually I would say like 24 hours of when I heard the news of Wayne passing, I had a headache, like, because I was trying to remember every little time that I'd spent with him and every little detail and every little word. So I was here and it was hurting and it was so much sadness. And I wasn't doing, like you said, like I wasn't doing anything.
Right, that the things you've
he
learned.
Would say. Like, it was like, hey, what about right here? Like, right. I'm right there. But like that switch, like how amazing is it that we get to experience that in this lifetime? Because I don't know, maybe you could like kind of clarify that, like that moment of switch, like that probably continues to happen for you where you'll, you know, there'll be like a temptation to slide into the the more human, darker side mm-hmm. of grief. And then it propels you to a whole other dimension of yourself.
Yeah, no, it happens all the time, and not even just with grief. I mean, my dad used to talk about how feeling good is feeling God. You know, when you're in a state of joy, your energy is higher, and you have more clarity. You're in the flow, and you know, and the opposite of that is when you're in sadness and you're slowed down. And it's not to say that you won't experience both of these things, but obviously the goal is to experience more joy. And I actually was listening to one of his podcasts the other day, and we've all heard this quote a million times. There is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. Mm-hmm. You know, and I grew up hearing that, but it took on a whole new meaning for me in that moment. You know how you can hear something a million times and then you hear it at a different time and it just means something totally different. And I realized, because, you know, I had a baby 7 months ago. I'm married and I'm almost 30 years old, and I'm in a perfect place to have a baby. But when I found out I was pregnant, I was upset and I wasn't excited. I was, I just immediately, we weren't trying to get pregnant. I mean, obviously we weren't being that careful because we did, but I did not think that I was going to get pregnant. So I was surprised. And I was at first, again, my mind on this hamster wheel of like, my life is over. My life as I know it is over. My freedoms are gone. My happiness is gone, you know, and it just kept going on a circle. And I kept thinking of all the, and I love children, and I have nieces and nephews, and I love taking care of them, and on and on, but I couldn't see this as a good thing at first. Mm-hmm. And even throughout the pregnancy, I think I was just sort of in denial, about, I don't know. It was like, I wanted to see it as a bad thing, you know? And I got excited about it, but not completely. Like, I still had both sides of these sorts of thoughts. And, but now I have my son, and I'm so happy and I love him so much. And I, when my dad said that quote, I realized, like, you know, when you say there is no way to happiness, happiness is the way. You bring the happiness, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes our circumstances are outside of our control or are just not what we pictured. And then it's your choice to bring the happiness. You know, you can't say my way to happiness is not having a child till I'm 32 and having this career at this point and doing this and traveling or whatever, because that would be the way to happiness, but there is no way to happiness. It's whatever you're in, you can bring the happiness. And I've realized that with being a mother to my son, there's obviously a lot of sacrifice in being a mother, as you know, and you're giving up a lot and you're in the home a lot, when sometimes I just want to get out of the house, and now it's getting cold here and it's just not so easy and he needs a nap and whatever. And
cabin fever.
Yeah. And I'm telling myself that happiness is outside of my apartment right now, but I can flip that on its head at any moment and just bring happiness to what I'm doing in that moment, which is possibly playing peekaboo with him on the floor. But it can bring me happiness and it can bring me purpose. And I think that, I don't know how I got off on this tangent because we were talking about my dad.
Perfect.
But yeah, just it's made me realize that that I always have a choice, you know, just like after losing him, it was a choice to choose sooner and to see it as, and to step into that, like we were talking about, the energy of grief that can be positive. And it's been the same thing now. It's like just bringing happiness to everything that I do, because life is not a destination. It's not from point A to point B. And there is purpose and fulfillment and happiness, I think, in each of those, each step along the way, if you decide to find it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. If you decide to find it, it's so true. And it kind of brings back to like one of Wayne's like teachers, in a concentration camp, Frankl. No.
Yeah. Viktor Frankl.
Yeah. Yes. Where they truly had no choice on changing their environment.
Exactly.
And not comparing it to motherhood, but kind of bringing it to the awareness that, you know, when you can't change things
your
around you, you
yeah.
can absolutely change how you feel inside. It might take a little bit of work and a desire and a willingness, I guess, a willingness to change it. Like some people, I guess there's also this learned pessimism too. Like it's hard sometimes for people to say, well, do I deserve that? But the willingness to change it. And then there's a spark in there, in the peekaboo and in the, just watching them nap. Although all you want to do is nap and,
right.
Or maybe go have a coffee with a friend. And
yeah. All of the above. But yeah, no, totally. It's so much of what you said. I mean, I remember it's in the book, Man's Search for Meaning. He, mm-hmm. He writes about how, you know, he's in a concentration camp in Nazi Germany and he was forced. So it's an awful, awful experience. He's got people dying all around him. They're starving. They're not given any food. And one day he's given a bowl of soup that has a dead floating fish head in the soup. And he writes about how he was challenged and forced to find meaning and purpose in that, and to see it as this is food. This is what I've been presented with today. And that, again, like we're saying, that choice, obviously for him, a totally different set of circumstances and an enormous challenge. But he believes the reason he survived is he was able to find meaning in his time in the concentration camp and to see beauty in the dead floating fish head that mm-hmm. was his dinner that day. And
that allowed him to survive when other people might not have.
He credits that
inner state.
Yeah.
For having
brought him a strength that he doesn't feel that other people had. If you weren't, you know, if you're so defeated and you have no purpose, and obviously there are levels of this, you know, and I think that we're not all in concentration camps, but we are all in circumstances that can be challenging and, or that we can perceive as not what we want to be having in our life right now. But if you can find the purpose and the meaning in it, I think that, you know, that can just make all the difference. It does. It starts that spark and it brings inspiration that before wasn't there.
This episode of the podcast is supported by 1UP Fitness. Are you tired of traditional gyms and looking for a better way to get fit? 1UP Fitness can help you get in the shape you want in as little as 30 minutes per week. It sounds too good to be true, but by using advanced exercise science and equipment, they can actually deliver on that promise. Controlled resistance training is the key to making sure your muscles get the exact stimulation they need for optimum improvement in the shortest period of time. I've been training there for almost 2 years. There is virtually no impact on my schedule because the slow and safe movements don't generate sweat, so there's no need to shower and dry off. In fact, I often go straight from a workout to a meeting. Just like they did for me, 1UP Fitness trainers can create a custom workout plan for each client that is specific to your current situation and the outcome you want to achieve. So find out if 1UP Fitness is right for you. They offer a no-obligation, free, one-hour consultation and training session. All you have to do is call 902-405-3661. 1UP Fitness. Do it right. Do it less, get results. Call today to book your free session, 902-405-3661, or visit 1upfitness.ca.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm curious to hear you a little bit on the topic of motherhood, because one of the things that I found was that, and I had similar to you, like I was doing my PhD when I became pregnant, and we had a restaurant too. We had a fine dining restaurant. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting the parallels. And, you know, and it wasn't like the best pregnancy. Like my pregnancies weren't, yay, I'm pregnant and like beautiful, glowing. No, I was sick and I was not feeling well.
Yeah.
And so then this like perceived lack of freedom, I think, because we're driven, I think also because we have dreams, we have vision, we want to, we have so much we want to do. Right.
Right.
And when my son was born, it brought me into my body like nothing else, like into the present moment so much than ever that it's almost like the invitation was really big to come home, to come home, to come back, to come back. And have you noticed that with your son, that he's a little mirror? Like, has that kind of shown up for you yet? Or how is he your teacher?
Yeah, well, I mean, it started during the pregnancy, actually, because so my sister and I had been working on this book before I found out I was pregnant. And then we sort of lost our mojo and we stopped. And we,
she had a baby too.
She had a bunch of babies. She's now got three babies. So yes. Yeah. And she had a whole host of things going on in her life. And it just kind of fell on the back burner. I mean, we would still talk about it from time to time, but we weren't putting any energy into it and we weren't making it happen. And I always felt that I had time to make it happen. You know, I thought like, okay, whatever. What else do I have going? I'll make the time for it someday, hopefully soon. But I wasn't actually making the time to finish the book. And as soon as I found out I was pregnant, I felt like, oh my God, I have to finish this book, because my perception of motherhood was I'm not going to have a second to myself ever. And I'm never going to do anything I want to do again, which has not been true. But that's what I was thinking at the time. I was just thinking about all the never agains, you know, on and on and on. So that pushed me to reach out to, you know, we had spoken to a literary agent, but not hired her. And that pushed me. I said, Serena, we're doing this book. I was like, she was pregnant too, actually, at that time. We were pregnant at the same time with boys. her son was born like 3.5 months before mine, but either way. So I said, we're doing this now because this is my last opportunity. Again, not true, but that's what I was thinking at the time. And so ironically, I thought my having a baby was going to be the end of my career, when really it's actually forced me and launched me into actually starting my career for the first time. I mean, wow. We hired the literary agent. She shopped our book for us, what we had so far. We got a book deal. Wow. We're finishing it now. And we're going to submit it by March 1st, and then it'll be out in the next year. So,
oh my gosh.
And he started being my teacher at that moment. And, and again, just, it's been such a, he's my teacher because he's my teacher. But the other things that I've learned, like just the idea that I kept telling myself that my life is over once I have a baby, that I'm only having a baby, it just isn't true. And how many times do our minds tell us these things
that are not true?
That are not true. And I think it's important to question, you know, if your mind is putting you in a bad place, I mean, sometimes our egos are lying to us, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think most of the time they are.
Our egos for sure.
Yeah. I had this experience when I was, I got the privilege to spend a couple of days with your father on Maui in June. He was teaching a writing retreat there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
I was there actually, but not at the retreat, but
okay.
In 2015.
In 2015. And yeah, it was in June, like 11th or something like that. Okay. Yeah. And, why was I? Oh yeah. So, and he was helping me, with my book proposal. And I mean, the gratitude I feel like for that is just beyond like that. I can't, the gift in that was just that. It was incredible. He was so generous. Mm. He was so generous. And you know that.
Right. No, of course.
He was generous with his time. He was generous with his love. And he was just generous with attention when he wanted to. And he, I say 99% of the time he wanted to, he would extend himself further than most people I know.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah. And I think like exactly that teaching that you just said, like I had this kind of epiphany around that morning, because, you know, I said to him, you know, like, this is not going to happen. He's like, it's already a done deal. And he didn't know that. Like he wouldn't have known that, because Reed hadn't read it yet. Like no one,
right.
There was nothing in motion yet, but he was looking at me like, you know that, and you're doubting it, and your doubts are false. They're false.
Right.
Can you feel the difference? Mm-hmm. And when he said that to me, like I remember we were on the patio or something, and it clicked in. Like I know now that every time my ego's trying to tell me that I'm smaller than this knowing inside me, it's not true. It's never the truth.
You're just getting in your own way. And we all do it, you know?
Exactly. The how and the when, I mean, that's kind of out of our hands, but this knowing that it's us, then it's the path, that it's the, that it's who we really are. That's, that's different than the ego saying, well, you're this version of your beauty, or you're a smaller version of
No, you know, yeah, I think our mind plays tricks on us all the time. It's funny that you keep saying the knowing, because that's the title of our book, actually, is the knowing. Oh, so wow. You keep saying going back to that knowing, but that's what we couldn't decide on a title because we're merging, Serena and I are writing it together. We're kind of merging two writings and mm-hmm. we had different ideas of titles. And anyway, once we heard the knowing, we sort of had a knowing that was the title, but
perfect.
It's just because it was returning to the knowing that, yes. So many things that the knowing that our dad, this was his time, you know, mm-hmm. and the knowing that he doesn't really leave, that, you know, we're not these physical bodies, we're all energy. And, you know, so eventually the physical has to die, but what's within us, our souls, our spirits, you know, whatever, the universal, our highest self cannot die because we're birthless and we're deathless. And going back to the knowing that I had the tools to get me through this, you know, it's constantly just returning to that knowing. Like you said, when you're ego is telling you that you're smaller, returning to the knowing that you're not, and that you're, mm-hmm. you know, you can quiet that part of your mind, mm-hmm. that you can try to at least. And
we're just not taught that in school, you know, growing right. up, that's the guide and that's the compass. Because it's not logical all the time. It doesn't make complete sense all the time. Mm-hmm. But to, you know, that I love that that's what your book is about, because everybody, like including me, can use a reminder on what does knowing feel like, how does it come to people, what's the experience inside their bodies of knowing. Mm-hmm. So for you, like, do you know what your body feels like when you know?
You know, I think that there is there's so many voices in your head and there's so many distractions. But I'm reading a book right now called The Surrender Experiment. And have you read it?
I haven't read it, but I heard of it.
Yeah, it's by Michael Singer. And it's about his story of his life. And he just makes a commitment to surrender to whatever life presents to him, to just always say yes, every opportunity, say yes. And so then he just keeps getting presented these opportunities that make him uncomfortable, but he agreed to surrender and to say yes. So he keeps saying yes. And this is over the course of like 30 years. And he ends up becoming super successful, very spiritual, highly evolved person, and very fulfilled and happy. And what I've realized by reading his story is that, you know, there's a flow to life. And when you're in the flow, like things are easy, things make sense, there is a clarity. And I constantly try and remind myself to just be in that flow and not fight the process of life. So, you know, with finding out I was pregnant, stop fighting it. Just, you're pregnant now. This is where you are. Go mm-hmm. with the flow, you know, and so for me, actually, when have you heard the song "I Hope You Dance" by Leanne Womack?
Oh, yeah, it makes me cry every time.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. And when I was once in the car with my dad, and that song came on the radio, and we listened to it because we both loved the song. And at the end of the song, he said, "I agree with every single line in that song except for one." And he's like, can you guess which one it is? And I was like, well, we have to listen to the song again. And so we did. And I didn't guess correctly. But anyway, I tried a few and I don't remember my guesses, but I just remember I didn't get the answer right. But there's a line in there that says, "I hope you never settle for the path of least resistance." And he said, you should always take the path of least resistance. When you're not experiencing, resistance, you're in the flow. Mm. You know, there's a flow to the universe. There's a flow to our paths. And when there's resistance, maybe you're not on the path, you know, and that doesn't mean you don't work hard and you don't, you know, but it should feel good and it should flow. And mm-hmm. you're continually getting red lights and, you know, roadblocks that, you know, maybe you're not in the flow. So mm-hmm. take a step back and ask to be guided onto the flow and onto your path and to find this path of least resistance. And so that's sort of where I'm trying to take my life, is just to, every time an opportunity is presented to me, if it feels good and it sounds good, go with it. And if I'm trying to achieve something and it's hard and it's uncomfortable and in a way that's not good, you know, okay, maybe this isn't for me, you mm-hmm. know?
And yeah. And are, you know, and then sometimes people will take if it's not flowing as a sign that they should throw the whole thing out, which also is not quite true.
No, yeah, I think it's
more like about just saying, okay, there's something about this I'm pushing against that's not working. Maybe right. Not the whole thing, because the no, you know, maybe we're doing it because it came from a knowing in the first place. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's what I mean. It doesn't mean every time you're challenged by something, you stop. Like, Right. I just think that there is, there's a way to go with the flow and to surrender to the flow of life. And in this book, when Michael Singer does that, his life takes off and he winds up, you know, in all the places that he wanted to be that maybe they weren't wrapped and packaged the way he thought they were going to be, but he still achieved what he wanted. So it's like, you're not giving up on your desires, but you're allowing them to flow the way that they should. And I don't know how to like define that for everyone. I just feel like it's a knowing that you have within yourself that, you know, that you ask and that you try and stay in that sort of, I hate to keep saying the word flow, but flowing energy as much as you can. Cause I think that there is an energy.
I think it's important. Like you said it really well. And I think it's important to hear it over and over again. Cause we all, throughout our day, step away from that flow and that knowing. And, it's a practice. It's a practice because the whole world's telling us that this is where we're supposed to take our cues from, when the knowing is more, it's deeper in the body. It's not in the ego. It's not in the mind. And it's just not something we're used to. So, so my last question for you, Sage, and it's a question I ask all my guests, is what is life, so where is life asking you to be courageous right now? I guess I can also like kind of rephrase the question in where are you asked right now to be brave and to kind of jump off the cliff and hope your wings will appear.
Yeah, I would say it's honestly in saying yes to things like this, to doing podcasts and interviews and because it's like we talked about at the beginning, there's a nervousness. I've never done an interview where at the end I say like, oh my God, I did so bad. I never want to do that again. Every time after I do it, I feel so good. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I have an energy and I come up with things that I had no idea that I even knew that weren't even in my realm of thoughts that I was conscious of. But for whatever reason, when I'm asked to do these things, I feel nervous that I won't succeed, that I will bomb it, you know, that I will let the person down or whatever. And so for me, that's the place that's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of places in my life asking for courage right now, especially being a mom. And again, just quieting that voice that tells me about the other things I could be doing right now. And staying in the joy of being a mother, because I'll tell you, every time I encounter, I live in an apartment building, every time I encounter another parent or another person in the elevator, they say hi to the baby and then they say, how old is he? And I say, however old he is on that day. And they say, oh, I have an 18-year-old. Time flies. Just enjoy it. They say, enjoy it because A, they have an 18-year-old, but also just like enjoy every day because time flies. And that's the thing I hear the most from parents who are parents of older kids now. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I had those days back when they were just little babies and it just goes by so fast. So finding the courage to do that, you know, it does take courage to, like we've been talking about the whole day, just staying in the joy, bringing the happiness to what you're doing. So on that part of my life, it's that. And in my professional life, it's, you know, it's saying yes and showing up for things like interviews and podcasts that take me out of my comfort zone, but in a good way in the end. You know, in the beginning, it feels nervous. And in the end, it feels like, of course, this was beautiful. This is what I'm meant to be doing, you know?
Exactly. I hope you remember that after this conversation, because you have such an ease to you. I think you could, you know, not even know you're coming on a podcast, like no 2 minutes prior, and you could have been like doing something super busy before and you would still nail it, Sage. I swear. So I hope you never forget that all you have to do is just show up That's it.
Thank you so much.
There really is in the field that you're in, and which is like, you know, what I perceive you as in is this like kind of more of the spiritual psychology. Mm-hmm. You know, just being in the moment, being present to that energy inside your body, you have the wisdom is right there, and all the stories, you know them. So
right. It's true.
They're all right there. So whatever one wants to pop up will come. And it's so much more fun too.
And stressing. And yeah. I always
and
like,
even for the person, like,
I have like notes. I didn't look at this.
No, exactly.
not one time, you know, exactly. I didn't write these today, but they're old notes I have that, you know, and again, yeah. Your ego tells you have to prepare, and
yeah,
and then you come and then mm-hmm. I feel inspired by talking mm-hmm. to you, and you know, and everything just flows.
Exactly. So. There's that more of that and just that really, because you're natural, and I look forward to being in the audience when you speak again. I know it will happen, and the time when and how, like, who, that's right. out of our
You that's
know,
where
control.
You surrender.
Exactly. But I feel that very, very strongly. And I feel very grateful that you are following your path and your purpose for everybody who's listening in, and for everybody who will get the chance to read your book, you and Serena's book, which is really exciting.
Thank you.
Yes. So tell me again when the book is coming out.
We're aiming for winter or spring of 2021. So okay. like over a year away.
Okay. So we'll make sure that we share it.
Yeah.
We'll wide.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sage, for being on the podcast today. It was really great talking to you.
Yeah. Likewise. Thank you for having me again.
You've been listening to Embodied with host Anne Bay Rebay, produced by me, Paul McGinnis. Thanks to recording engineers Francisco Lopes and Charles Austin of Ocean Floor Studio. Post-production by Daniel Bach. Special thanks to Glass Tiger for the theme song, This Is Your Life. You can support this podcast by visiting soultribehub.com and signing up for a free membership. You'll receive exclusive invites to soulful events and gain instant access to behind-the-scenes video, meditations, and our virtual book club. Got a question for Anne or an upcoming guest? You can submit your question by text, audio, or video at soultribehub.com. It could be featured on a future episode. You can also support this show by showing a little love and attention to our sponsors. If you haven't already, please subscribe and leave your positive rating and reviews on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening now. This has been a Soul Tribe Press production in collaboration with Tidal Trans Creative. And that's why I say, this is your life, this is your life.